It is 5 o'clock.
Is what I'm saying.
It's 5 o'clock. I'm going ahead and call our City of Columbia, Missouri pre-council. I don't know why it says preliminary agenda. I think that's our agenda for tonight. So I'll go ahead and kick it right over to Dave Sorrell, Utilities Director.
Well, thank you for letting us be here this evening. You know, we've got renewable energy goals in our ordinance. We've got renewable energy goals in our climate action and adaptation plan. They're not the same. And then we have a lot of people suggesting we look at getting to 100% renewable by 2030. So we engaged the services of the Energy Authority, which was our market participant, to do the study of some different scenarios of achieving 100% renewable by 2030 and what that might cost. So the TEA is going to present this. They presented it to the Water and Light Advisory Board in July, and then we followed up with what the rate impacts would be. So once they're finished presenting their study, we'll do the rate impacts and then ask additional questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lou, and he can introduce his folks, and they can get started.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I'm Lou Rosenthal, account director for the Energy Authority for the City of Columbia. Yeah, we have Demir Gormazet with us, and Jim Myers, Brandon Williams, Jonathan Mead, and Marquis Kimmy. They were all involved in the work that we did on the study. An interesting study, to say the least. A lot of utilities, public private in particular, looking at very similar things, asking lots of questions. What's it cost? What's it take to do this type of thing? And depending on your asset mix, it could be a pretty adventurous decision and difficult decision to make on how to move forward. So the idea is to give you some ideas of what we saw under various scenarios. We made certain assumptions of costs and things going forward. And we got a lot of good information to build those assumptions. And Brandon and Jim and the others can explain some of those if you have questions on them as we go through this. And Brandon will go through the analysis and all the various results that we got from it. And hopefully this will give you some good insights on what you could be facing under the various scenarios. And we'll go from there. And we can discuss it and answer any questions you have as we're going along.
Thank you.
So I'll go ahead and... Brandon, I'll go ahead and let you kick it off. I think you'll run the, are you going to be able to run the presentation, or Sarah or Aaron, if one of you guys want to run it from your end, you let us know what works best.
Brandon, it would work best if you ran it.
Yeah, I have the slides pulled up here, and I can start sharing. Appreciate the intro, Lou. Sharing my screen. Can y'all see the title slide?
Yes.
Awesome. All right. Let me go ahead and get into it then. So this is our 100% renewable study for Columbia. This first slide here, this really just goes over the purpose of this study and kind of the scope, the different scenarios that we've evaluated. Our project purpose was to determine the impact of achieving a 100% renewable energy and capacity portfolio for Columbia by 2030. This was a 20-year study beginning in 2024 and extending through the end of 2043. As for scope, we ran six different scenarios in total, the first being our base case. This is kind of a business as usual case where we didn't assume any renewable goal. And then we had five different alternate cases, each with varying degrees of different constraints as far as renewable adoption and existing resource retirement. I'll go through these alternate cases one by one on our next slide. I think it has a better visual to explain the different assumptions behind these scenarios. So an overview of the scenarios, like I mentioned, our base case is really a business as usual. There is no 100% renewable requirement. The table here, this is just showing five different assumptions that differentiate these alternate cases that we evaluated. The first being 100% renewable requirement by 2030, the use of renewable energy credits, or REC, whether Columbia would divest from its existing coal resources, whether it would retire its existing natural gas resources, and then our last assumption here, whether Columbia would retire Sikeston as early as possible. So going through these alternate cases, our first alternate case, really the most basic one, we just assumed that Columbia would be meeting its 100% renewable requirement by 2030. Now, this was an energy requirement, not a capacity requirement. We'll look at that in the future alternate cases. In this scenario, another thing I want to mention, we're not assuming an existing retirement of Columbia's current generation fleet, and we did not allow our model to use renewable energy credits to meet this renewable requirement. Alternate case two, same set of assumptions as alternate case one, the only difference being the use of RECs.
All right, it is 5 o'clock. That's what I'm saying. It's 5 o'clock. I'm going ahead and call our City of Columbia, Missouri pre-council. I don't know why it says preliminary agenda. I think that's our agenda for tonight. So I'll go ahead and kick it right over to Dave Sorrell, Utilities Director.
Well, thank you for letting us be here this evening. You know, we've got renewable energy goals in our ordinance. We've got renewable energy goals in our climate action and adaptation plan. They're not the same. And then we have a lot of people suggesting we look at getting to 100% renewable by 2030. So we engaged the services of the Energy Authority, which was our market participant, to do a study of some different scenarios of achieving 100% renewable by 2030 and what that might cost. So the DEA is going to present this. They presented it to the Water and Light Advisory Board in July, and then we followed up with what the rate impacts would be. So once they're finished presenting their study, we'll do the rate impacts and then ask additional questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lou, and he can introduce his folks, and they can get started.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I'm Lou Rosenthal, account director for the Energy Authority for the City of Columbia. Yeah, we have Demir Gormazet with us, and Jim Myers, Brandon Williams, Jonathan Mead, and Marquis Kimmy. They were all involved in the work that we did on the study. An interesting study, to say the least. A lot of utilities, public fire in particular, looking at very similar things, asking lots of questions. What's it cost? What's it take to do this type of thing? And depending on your asset mix, it could be a pretty adventurous decision and difficult decision to make on how to move forward. So the idea is to give you some ideas of what we saw under various scenarios. We made certain assumptions of costs and things going forward. And we got a lot of good information to build those assumptions. And Brandon and Jim and the others will can explain some of those if you have questions on them as we go through this. And Brandon will go through the analysis and all the various results that we got from it. And hopefully this will give you some good insights on what you could be facing under the various scenarios. And we'll go from there. And we can discuss it and answer any questions you have as we're going along.
Thank you.
So I'll go ahead and... Brandon, I'll go ahead and let you kick it off. I think you will run the, are you going to be able to run the presentation, or Sarah or Aaron, if one of you guys want to run it from here, and you let us know what works best.
Brandon, it would work best if you ran it.
Yeah, I have the slides pulled up here, and I can good. Start sharing. Appreciate the intro, Lou. Sharing my screen. Can y'all see the title slide?
Yes.
Yes.
Awesome. All right. Let me go ahead and get into it then. So this is our 100% renewable study for Columbia. This first slide here, this really just goes over the purpose of this study and kind of the scope, the different scenarios that we our project purpose was to determine the impact of achieving a 100% renewable energy and capacity portfolio for Columbia by 2030. This is a 20-year study beginning in 2024 and extending through the end of 2043. As per scope, we ran six different scenarios in total. The first being our base case. This is kind of a business as usual case where we didn't assume any renewable goal. And then we had five different alternate cases, each with varying degrees of different constraints as far as renewable adoption on existing resource retirement. I'll go through these alternate cases one by one on our next slide. I think it has a better visual to explain the different assumptions behind. So an overview of the scenarios, like I mentioned, our base case is really a business as usual. There is no 100% renewable requirement. The table here, this is just showing five different assumptions that differentiate these alternate cases that we evaluated. The first being 100% renewable requirement by 2030, the use of renewable energy credits, or REC, whether Colombia would divest from its existing coal resources, whether it would retire its existing natural gas resources, and then our last assumption here, whether Colombia would retire Sykeston as early as possible. So going through these alternate cases, our first alternate case, really the most basic one, we just assumed that Colombia would be meeting its 100% renewable requirement by 2030. Now, this was an energy requirement, not a capacity requirement. We look at that in the future alternate cases. In this scenario, another thing I want to mention, we're not assuming an existing retirement of Colombia's current generation fleet, and we did not allow our model to use renewable energy credits to meet this renewable requirement. Alternate case two, same set of assumptions as alternate case one, but the only difference being the use of RECs or renewable energy renewable energy credit is allowed in this scenario. Our alternate case three here, again, this alternate case assumes 100% renewable requirement by 2030. And this scenario also assumes that Colombia would divest from its existing coal resources during 2030 as well. This includes the Sykeston, ITAN, and First State purchase power agreements that Colombia currently has for those three different plants. In alternate case four, again, 100% renewable requirement. And in this case, we assume that Colombia would be divesting from its coal resources and also retiring its local natural gas. This would include the Colombia Energy Center natural gas generators as well as the Plant B natural gas generators. Now, our last scenario, alternate case five, again, 100% renewable requirement by 2030. And in this scenario, we just assume that the Sykeston plant would retire as early as possible that we foresaw, which was 2028, is what we assumed the Sykeston retiring in this alternate case. Any questions on these different cases before we start getting into our model assumptions?
I just have one clarification. For the base case, you mentioned it does not assume any renewable energy coals. I assume you mean outside of the existing ones in the ordinance. Yes or no?
So in the base case, we didn't model any renewable energy goals. This includes the existing goals that Colombia has established.
Okay. Or the existing contracts we have, renewables, any of that?
So we did model the existing wind and solar contracts that Colombia does have. So those are incorporated into the model. So if there are any existing goals that Colombia has already met and achieved with its existing renewable resources, then that would be built in.
Okay. Any other questions?
Does that help clarify?
Yeah, I mean, you answered it. You can go in.
All right. All right. Moving forward into our model assumptions section. Before we get into our slide showing the assumptions from this study, I wanted to go through a couple of definitions just to clarify what I mean by different terms, different forms of capacity that we're going to mention in future slides. I know the nomenclature can be kind of confusing. We're using different versions of capacity, but we need different things. But I wanted to use this slide to help clarify that before we really get to our assumptions. There's a few different definitions for different kinds of capacity that we will mention. The first being nameplate capacity. What this means is really just the maximum rated output for a particular generator. So nameplate capacity for a wind farm that is 100 megawatts would mean that wind farm could generate 100 megawatts maximum. As for firm capacity, what this is it is a measure of a generator's ability to generate power and provide it to the grid when needed. This is a construct that is calculated by MISO, and it is used for planning requirements. It is a requirement that Columbia has to satisfy under MISO is ensuring that it's firm capacity for all of its different resources. And to be at or above forecasted peak load or peak power demand plus a certain percentage or reserve margin. Once again, this is a construct that is assigned to each resource and it is evaluated by them. So. And the last definition I have here, bilateral capacity. Yes.
I think that was just silverware.
From the group, I thought I heard one.
I think it's just silverware. Sorry.
Okay. No worries. The last definition is bilateral capacity. All this is firm capacity that Columbia might purchase directly from another utility or generation resource owner. In the case where utilities have to meet the planning requirements established by MISO, and maybe they don't have the resources to meet that requirement, they might purchase firm capacity directly from another utility or another generation resource. So that's what really this means, is you're purchasing that firm capacity from a resource that you don't actually have an ownership share. One thing I want to note that this purchase can be long-term. Firm capacity purchase, or it could just be for a year or a season. Getting into firm capacity assumptions for this study, one of the most difficult things from a planning perspective is planning for how much firm capacity will be awarded for different kinds of generators. Particularly, this has been tricky for renewables. And so what this slide is showing is our assumed firm capacity that each different resource type will be awarded as a percentage of its nameplate or its maximum rated output. You can see that this projected firm capacity is expecting to change over time for different resources. And I'll give you an example here to hopefully clarify. For example, I have down here IATAN, which is Columbia's coal resources. In this study, we are assuming that IATAN receives around an 89% firm capacity accreditation. So Columbia would effectively receive 89% of the resource's nameplate capacity in firm capacity every single year of this study. Something I want to mention, obviously you can see that our assumed firm capacity accreditation is changing, particularly for solar, as well as for battery storage, which is shown in orange. For solar, down in the bottom half of this graph, in yellow, you can see that our assumed firm capacity is going down over time. What this means is that over time, the same, we're assuming that the same solar resource would receive less firm capacity from MISO. Beginning right around the 45% level in 2024, and then ending just shy of the 20% level during the later years of this study. What this is reflective of is the assumption that as we get further out into the future, more solar resources are added on to MISO's system. And so as a result of that, this shifts the risky periods from a planning perspective from traditionally, they've been in the late afternoon hours where folks, during the summer at least, when folks are running their AC systems at maximum to try and cool down their homes. And the assumption is that this risky period shifts from those late afternoon hours to the early evening hours. And that's really because out into the future, we're assuming that those late afternoon hours also coincide with periods where solar farms are generating electricity. So there's a surplus of power in those periods where currently there isn't, because there isn't quite as much solar on MISO 6. So that is really the assumption built into and why, you know, we are assuming that solar resources will receive less firm capacity in the future compared to current levels for summer. I will mention that these assumptions are based on a study that MISO actually performed. It's from their regional resource assessment. These assumptions were from the 2022 version of this study. The 2023 version, I believe, yet to be published fully. And so this takes into account changes in the generation fleet across MISO's system over time. All right. Last thing I'll mention here for wind resources. You know, our assumption is that wind resources in the future will receive firm capacity accreditation fairly in line with what they're currently receiving, which is in the 15 to 20% range. All right. Now, getting into the actual resource options that we evaluated in the study. These are options that we allowed our planning model to choose to invest in during each year in the study. The first one being a solar purchase power agreement, or PPA. The PPA is mentioned a lot here in future slides. All a purchase power agreement, or PPA, is a contractual agreement to purchase power from a generation owner. Columbia currently has several of these for renewable and non-renewable resources. And so this is what we evaluated for solar and battery storage, that Columbia wouldn't actually own the generation, they could purchase it contractually from a third party. Now, solar PPAs are largely priced on a dollar per megawatt hour scale. So you pay for every megawatt hour power that is produced from the solar farm. And we will look in future slides at our changes and our assumed price of solar PPAs through the duration of the study. These current prices shown here are just the PPA prices as of the first year of the study. So going down through our assumptions, we allow the model to select 50 megawatt block solar purchase power agreement. Each of these agreements was assumed to be a 15-year contract length. And lastly, we assumed that these contracts would have a lead time of 3 years. All that means is we assumed a 3-year delay between when the contract was done and when the project actually began generating. You know, I think this lead time is important, particularly because we are assuming you know, pretty hefty premiums in the price of the purchase power agreement, at least in the near term. You know, there are a number of delays that could affect this lead time here for a solar or a wind project. And you know, Columbia has recently experienced this with doing solar, which was recently got was canceled. So This, you can see the same assumption in lead time also holds true for our assumed wind PPA option. We are assuming a 50 megawatt wind PPA contract, again, 15-year length. Moving along down, battery storage purchase power agreement, we are assuming the model has an option to select a battery storage option. We are assuming a fixed price purchase power agreement, which I'll note later when we actually look at the assumed price over time of these battery storage options. And then we assume the 25 megawatt battery storage PPA. Again, a 15-year contract length with that 3-year lead time. Our next option will be evaluated as bilateral capacity purchase power agreement. Like I mentioned, for the previous option, we did assume that the price of bilateral capacity would change over time, and I will review that assumed price change over time in future slides. We allowed our model to select 5 megawatt chunks of bilateral capacity purchased from another resource. Did I hear a question from the group?
No, sorry, from loud.
Okay. No, no worries. I want to make sure I'm not missing any questions. And for bilateral capacity, we assume that Columbia can purchase 1-year bilateral capacity PPAs, so short duration contract. The last resource option, renewable energy credit, or REC, we assume that the model could invest in RECs at a fixed price through the duration of our study of $3.50 per megawatt hour. And this, as I mentioned earlier, this renewable energy credit was only allowed to be collected in one of our alternate cases.
So, Brandon, I am going to ask just a quick, I think I understand when we talk about the difference between like a solar PPA and a bilateral capacity PPA. A solar is like us with like that solar farm, like you mentioned the Boone Stevens example. Whereas a bilateral capacity, would that be like if we were doing it with like Sykeston Power, if they were doing a renewable, we'd be doing it with another utility? Is that an example of a bilateral capacity?
Correct. Yeah, that's an example of bilateral capacity. You know, and something I'll touch on in the future slides, just kind of explain this a bit further here. Bilateral capacity generally occurs when you have a utility that has more firm capacity than they need. Maybe they have an excess of generation resources, and they actually have more firm capacity than their requirement for planning by MISO, and so they can sell bilateral capacity from a particular resource, or you can kind of just pool together the capacity and sell it directly, not tied to an individual resource.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. So getting into our PPA price forecast, this first slide here shows our solar PPA price forecast. This is shown in nominal dollars. One thing I want to mention is that we are assuming a fixed price purchase power agreement. So what this reflects is the price of the PPA that you would be locking in during a particular year. Another thing I want to mention on this slide is that these years here denote the year that the project would actually begin generating. We are assuming that 3-year lead time, so the decision to invest in a solar PPA would have to be made 3 years prior than the prices that were shown. So for example, in 2026, we show a solar PPA price in the $27 per megawatt hour range. And that contract would actually have to be signed in 2023. It's something I do want to mention, these price forecasts, we use information from a combination of sources. We use data from a company called Level 10 Energy. They have regional PPA price data that they publish quarterly. We also build our forecast change in these prices using capital cost projections from two different sources, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and then S&P Commodity. So getting into the actual trend in our assumed PPA price forecast, you can see that we are expecting a pretty substantial drop in the price of solar PPA through the 2020. Some of this is reflective of the technology itself maturing, the solar panel technology maturing, is what I'm referencing there. And then, you know, there are additional assumptions that, particularly in the near term, something that we've observed is a lot of premium placed on solar PPA prices, you know, really just due to things like supply chain constraints. Given that there's a higher demand solar PPA, or excuse me, solar panels that could be supplied in the near term. So we are assuming some higher prices due to that. And then once we get into kind of the early 2030s, you can see that our solar PPA price forecast bottoms out right around that $45 per megawatt hour range. Again, that's in nominal dollars, not in real dollars. So there's inflation accounted there. And then from the mid-2030s on, you can see our assumed solar PPA price is increasing slightly. You know, what we are assuming here in these later years is that while there are some slight technological improvements in solar panels, we are assuming that inflationary impacts are offsetting those incremental improvements in the technology itself. Our next slide showing forecasted PPA prices for wind farms. Again, these prices are in dollars per megawatt hour, nominal dollars per megawatt hour, excuse me. And these prices are reflecting the year that the project would begin operating. So the decision to sign a PPA would have to be made 3 years prior to the prices reflected in this graph. Really, the two things I want to note on this PPA price forecast. For wind, you can see we're not projecting nearly the same decline in PPA prices that we saw for solar. Just less impact due to the supply chain constraints in the near term. In addition to that, you know, we are assuming that there's less technological improvement for wind technology through the 2020s compared to solar technology. And so, you know, that's reflected in a more shallow decline in forecasted wind PPA prices. And kind of similar to solar, we are projecting these wind PPA prices to bottom out in the early 2030s, call it 2033. And then from there on out, the price of these contracts will slightly increase over time as slight improvement in the technology itself are allocated by inflationary stats. This next slide here, this is actually comparing our forecasts for solar and wind PPA prices. For wind, we're showing the forecasted price in red, and then for solar, we're showing the forecasted price in gray. What I have shown here is the price both in nominal dollars and then in 2023 dollars to kind of take out the impact due to inflation. So in nominal pricing are these solid lines, and the 2023 price dollar pricing are those dashed lines. A couple of things to note, and you can see for the solar, you know, as we saw with the nominal dollar pricing, real dollar pricing, we are expecting, you know, the cost of solar PPAs to decline pretty substantially. And then once we get to about 2033, you can see the cost of wind versus solar really becomes pretty competitive on a dollar per megawatt hour scale, both in real dollars and in nominal dollars. You know, we're assuming that solar panel technology has matured at this point, and so, you know, both wind and solar technology are seeing incremental gains, which is reflected in the slight decline of the cost of these purchase power agreements in real dollars, but you can see in nominal dollars, as I mentioned earlier, inflation is outpacing those incremental gains in the technology. So, all right, moving along for battery storage, you can get pricing. One thing I want to note before I get into the actual trends here, we are assuming that battery storage purchase power agreements are fixed cost purchase power agreement. In the prior two examples for wind and solar, we are assuming a production based purchase power agreement where you pay a fixed rate based on every megawatt hour generated. For battery storage, we're assuming it is different, where it's a fixed cost agreement, and you get to operate the battery, discharge and discharge the battery on the fly, with some constraints in there, namely a one cycle per day limitation for these battery projects. So for battery storage, you can see that we are assuming, at least in the near term, pretty hefty decline in the cost of a purchase power agreement as battery storage technology matures through the late 2020s and really hits a bottoming out point in the early 2030s or 2032, 2033. From there on out, we are assuming another slight increase over time of battery storage PPAs. Again, assuming that by the early 2030s, we're at the point where there are some slight technological improvements in battery storage technology, but being offset by inflation at that point. All right, next up, bilateral capacity. So our bilateral capacity forecast here, this is assuming that Columbia would purchase this capacity from another resource for an entire planning year. This has kind of gotten a bit more confusing since MISO switched from an annual planning requirement to a seasonal requirement. But we are assuming that Columbia needs some capacity for one season, that they would have to purchase that for all seasons in the planning year. Another thing I want to note, our capacity price forecast, bilateral capacity price forecast, we're assuming that these prices are reflective of the cost of purchasing bilateral capacity from any available resource, right? So Columbia wouldn't be specifically purchasing bilateral capacity from renewable resources. If that were the case, then we would assume that there would be some cost increase in purchasing that as bilateral capacity specifically from renewable sources. Something I will mention, similar to the battery storage PPA, this is a fixed cost product. So you pay for a fee, there's no energy tied to it. This is specifically for planning purposes, as I mentioned earlier. As for our assumed price forecast, we are assuming some near-term increases as we go through the 2020s, followed by a slight decrease over time in projected bilateral capacity prices. Some of this is indicative of projected trends on the actual generation trend for within MISO, assuming that the generation footprint will change over time and thereby the price of capacity will be impacted. Really, the main thing I want to point out with this capacity price forecast is we are assuming a pretty hefty premium on bilateral capacity prices. There is a cap on bilateral capacity prices that MISO sets every single year. And it's somewhere in this $8 to $9 per kilowatt month range. So we are assuming that capacity prices, if they have to be purchased from another resource, are pretty close to that maximum level that it could be in a given year.
I'm going to ask a really quick question. It's more for staff. How do we define the firm capacity that we get through like our agreements with the Missouri Public Utilities Alliance?
It's actually an amount. So we buy 66 megawatts of firm capacity from Sykes.
But so we don't like label that as you know, we just call that our firm capacity. We don't call that a but, you know what I mean? I was just trying to like in my head compare like the other things we
each
do.
Each one of those resources we have to add together to see what our total is.
Right.
And then we have to have our load plus some percentage.
Okay.
And then we have to make certain we have that. If we don't, we have to go to the market and buy some.
Right. I guess I'm just trying to think when you talk about bilateral capacity in my head, like what that might look like. And so I was like, oh, if like 9 utilities within MPUA went together on a regional project, you know what I mean? Would that be considered bilateral? And it might be through MPUA. Okay.
So okay. From Sykeston or IFAN or Prairie State, they're all bilateral.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, Brandon.
No, I appreciate the clarification. All right, so moving from our assumption section to the basis, so before I do this, does anybody have any questions on the assumptions or the assumption clarifications they'd like?
No, I guess, Brandon, I was looking really quickly at the MISO study that the assumptions had based on from 22. And they mentioned like the big federal investment in a lot of these kind of like renewable energies and I don't know, it's like carbon cap, all those things. But was I reading it right that it's kind of like it's too soon to tell to actually really put a lot of those into where our future capacity is because a lot of that investment's happening like in the next 3, you know what I mean? Like it's not going to be online. So the assumptions weren't really included.
Yeah. So let me go back. You're referencing this slide, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mark performed this study in likely early 2022. So this was prior to the IRA being passed. They will have some of that IRA, those IRA assumptions being built into their next study, but largely, really, what MISO uses as a basis for this evaluation is the current resources that are in the interconnection queue, basically,
right.
The current resources that folks are planning to build on MISO's system. So that's really the driving factor. If that interconnection queue changes, maybe more solar resources, put a spot in the queue and say that we want to build a solar farm here, then that will change the underlying assumption for this study.
Yeah. And I'm assuming, so I think it was that just last summer that Lou from your group presented to us about how many want to be in the queue, but because of transmission issues are not even getting started because of how long that is.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a really big problem. MISO has submitted a couple of revisions to their process. They've submitted them to the FERC. I don't believe they've been approved yet by the FERC. But this is an issue that MISO is trying to tackle, where they just have so many requests to study different interconnection resources, and they just can't handle being able to study all these requests in the time span.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to our base case results. So before we get into the results themselves, I want to go over a couple financial metrics that we use to compare our different runs. The first being net present value. This financial metric is the units are millions of dollars. It's a cost positive metric, so smaller number is better. It includes fixed generation costs, variable generation costs, generation revenues by selling their power into MISO, and then cost of purchasing load from MISO. I do want to mention that this financial metric is counted to $2.23.
Second financial metric, levelized cost of energy. All this is our, it's the net present value divided by the total load volume over the 20-year period that we are studying. So it's, the units for this metric are dollar per megawatt hour load. All right. So getting into our actual study results, we'll be looking at these tables here for each of our different scenarios. What is shown in this table is the annual build and retirement decisions made by our model. You can see we have our each year in our study shown here in the middle of this graph, 24 through 2043. We also have a row for different technology types, things like existing thermal resources, new solar PPAs, wind PPAs, battery storage, and bilateral capacity. And so the numbers that you're looking at here, these are the nameplate capacity of resources that are either being built in this given year or retired in this given year. But the retirement shown is the negative numbers. So for example, we see in 2027, there is 6 megawatts of wind PPAs that are lost under the retirement of the Bluegrass Wind PPA that ends in May 2027. Over on the right-hand side of this table, you can see we have our two financial metrics, again, net present value and levelized cost of energy. And we'll be comparing these two metrics between our base case and our different ultimate case. A couple of things to note from this base case, these base case results, you can see in 2027, as I mentioned, the Bluegrass Wind PPA expires and Columbia loses 6 megawatts of nameplate capacity from that resource. Also, the Dynegy capacity deal that Columbia is currently has expires in 2027, so Columbia loses 40 megawatts of bilateral capacity. From 2028 onward, you can see that these are varying amounts of bilateral capacity that our model is electing to purchase. And reason being is the model has to ensure that Columbia is meeting its firm capacity requirements, or my solar planet requirements, excuse me. So that's why we see those incremental bilateral capacity purchases going from 10 megawatts in 2028, all the way to 50 megawatts in 2043.
And just to clarify, based on that. Just to clarify, based on that third bullet, that bilateral capacity is referring to like fossil fuel bilateral, not a renewable.
Right. So we assume that the model would be kind of agnostic to what type of resource we're purchasing the bilateral capacity from. This could be from a fossil resource, could be from a renewable resource.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, we have one more question,
Is that true of the battery storage PPAs as well? That it would be, that doesn't indicate a source for the generation?
Right. You're correct in that assumption. We assume that the battery storage PPA would be a standalone project. It wouldn't be directly tied to a solar farm.
Any other questions? No. All right. Thank you.
Absolutely. The last thing, a couple things I'll mention on this slide. Our net present value of $1,024,000,000 in our base case. This isn't super valuable right now, but it will be in future slides if we compare this number to our other ultimate cases. Our model is projecting a levelized cost of energy $60.47 per megawatt hour of load, again, across the 20-year period. All right, so these next two slides, what this is showing is how the model is actually optimizing to make sure that Columbia is meeting its planning requirements from MISO. In this slide, these stacked bars here, these are showing
the different amounts of firm capacity that are being awarded for each of Columbia's generation resources. And they're kind of grouped by fuel type. So you can see, you know, assumed existing coal firm capacity in gray, existing natural gas firm capacity in orange, and so on. Again, this is just for the summer period. One other thing I'll note on this slide, the black line here, this is showing our forecast peak load. And then the red dashed line is our forecasted capacity requirement, which is around 7.5% above that peak load level. So what the model is ensuring is that the sum of our firm capacity, or the top of our stacked bar chart, is meeting that red line for each year of the study. You can see from 2027 onward, really in the base case, Columbia is just purchasing that bilateral capacity, which are the purple striped bar, in order to ensure that the utility is meeting its planning requirements. And so, visually, the summer is really the limiting factor here from a planning perspective. This is the period where the decision is being made by our model to purchase that firm capacity. It's not being done for the winter or another season. All right, I'm looking at a similar slide, but this is for winter planning requirements. So again, the same information. Our projected peak load for Columbia is that black line. Planning requirement is that red dashed line. You can see there's a larger amount of separation between peak load and capacity requirement. This is because during winter, that excess above peak load is higher than for the planning requirement purposes. Really, the main thing I want to point out on this slide is that during all the years of the study, Columbia has a certain amount of excess firm capacity during the winter season. Again, that bilateral capacity, which is that purple dash bar, is primarily being purchased for summer. And Columbia ends up having excess during the winter season. All right. Getting into our ultimate case results. So our first ultimate case involved Columbia meeting a 100% renewable energy requirement without the use of renewable energy credits. So you can see we're looking at a similar chart to what we saw earlier for the base case. We show the results from the base case at the top in this table, and then we show the results from our ultimate case one at the bottom here for comparison. Before I get into the actual build decisions, you can see again, in 2027 and also in case one, we are assuming that Bluegrass PPA expires and the Dynegy bilateral capacity purchase also expires. Now, in alternate case one, our model is electing to invest into a combination of wind and solar purchase power agreement. The model invests in a total of 250 megawatts wind purchase power agreement in 2028, 2029, and then 250 megawatts of solar purchase power agreements from 29 to 2031. So a combination of wind and solar in those early 2030s. Again, that's getting to that point where we are projecting purchase power agreement pricing for solar kind of bottom out. And then, in addition to this, in 2038, you can see the model likes to invest in an additional 50 megawatts of solar PPA. This is just to make sure that Columbia continues to meet its 100% renewable energy requirement as the load grows for the utility. In 2042, we have some retirement of some of those wind purchase power agreements, and in this year, in these last 2 years, the model likes to invest in solar PPA in order to make make sure that it again continues to hit that 100% renewable energy requirement. As for changes in net present value, there is a $159 million increase in net present value over the 20-year period when compared to base case. And levelized cost of energy, this is right around a $10 per megawatt hour increase in levelized cost of energy. Part of the reason why is the investment does have to be made in the late 20s, but the decision to purchase these PPAs has to be made a few years prior to that, when PPA prices haven't necessarily reached that sort of bottoming out point. In addition to this, in this scenario, Columbia would have pretty large excess of generation when we consider both the renewable portfolio, including the solar and wind PPAs, as well as the thermal resources that Columbia would own, coal and natural gas. So that is another contributing factor, the higher net present value in LCOE.
Brandon, I have a question for you. Sorry. On this one and the future ones as well, when the model shows the potential of 150 megawatts in 2028, is that because there are going to be those additional resources that are already approved in the they're in the queue going to be done? Or is this like ideal situation that this magic is going to happen?
So we're assuming that in 2028, for example, Columbia would have to sign that PPA in 2025, and then you would have a 3-year period. Like you mentioned, there is a risk of additional delays for a PPA, but we are building that lead time into that build decision.
Well, I guess I would just more of that, because it sounded like from our conversation last year that even the lead time in the queue is already really long. And so I guess since that's only like 5 years away, I was wondering if that is a confident number that by 2028, those resources might be available.
Yeah.
Your face says no. So, okay.
It's a tricky question. I do think that there has been an effort by MISO to alleviate some of these issues due to wait times. It's really yet to be approved, and so certainly this decision, this 150 megawatt PPA, for example, could be delayed another year or two as sitting and waiting in the queue. It's certainly a possibility. We are assuming that, the decision to invest in this purchase power agreement would have to be made pretty soon, assuming that 2025 decision time.
Okay. Yeah. And hold on, Dave, yeah.
Let me just point out, it's just one example, but that Boone Stevens project that we had a PPA with, I believe was approved in 18. If that's right. It's not, it's still not new, and they're still pursuing.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't anticipate they'll be able to come online at least 2 more years.
I think my question was more of that, not whether or not they'll get through the queue in this time, but that this is a real project that exists. You know what I mean? Or that is in somebody's planning stages to happen.
I don't think this was looked at as the project exists, so we know we can buy it.
Okay. Yeah, Nick.
But what this does is this gets us to 100% by 2030, assuming that we can get it, enter those PPAs. Correct?
Right, that's correct. In the study, we hadn't identified specific projects that individual projects that Columbia could invest in, for example. Yeah, you're correct. This is assuming that the potential wind or solar project is there to be invested in.
So I assume too, then, if we were to enter into other types of, you know, either between wind or solar PPAs in that time period in those amounts. For instance, 75 in the solar PPA in 29 and 75 in wind in 29. The numbers are what gets us to 100% renewable, regardless of the renewable source of that generator. Correct?
Yes.
Right. Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. Moving onward to alternate case two. As a refresher in this alternate case, we assume that Columbia would have to achieve the 100% renewable energy requirement by 2030, but the use of renewable energy credits would be permitted. Renewable energy credits, kind of as a refresher, just a credit that's received per megawatt hour of renewable energy that is generated, and you can purchase these bilaterally from a different generation owner or facility. And traditionally, they've been used to meet different sort of state requirements for renewable energy generation. And so in this scenario, you can see that our model elects to lean heavily on renewable energy credits to meet this 100% requirement. The model is in all years outside of 2033, you can see the model is investing in different amounts of bilateral capacity. This is just to make sure Columbia is meeting its funding requirements for MISO. But the model does invest in 100 megawatts of solar PPA in 2033. If you recall, this is actually a year where our PPA price forecast bottoms out. So our model is seeing that this is the cheapest rate that Columbia would be able to receive a solar PPA for. And so the model doesn't strictly use renewable energy credits. It does choose to build or invest in 100 megawatts of solar with a combination of the fact that it does provide for emerging capacity for planning purposes, but it's also, we're expecting that this is the cheapest year that Columbia can invest in this solar resource. As for cost impacts, you can see the net present value in alternate case two is only around $30 million above that of the base case. And levelized cost of energy is right around $1.50 per megawatt hour above that of the base case. The much lower cost impacts when compared to alternate case one. Now this slide here, this is comparing the cost premiums of these alternate cases versus the base case. So these bars here, this is showing the difference each year in our model between our two alternate cases, one and two, and our base case. So a higher bar would indicate a higher cost for this year relative to the base. Something I want to note is that for alternate case one, you can see this is increasing beginning in 2028, pretty aggressively. The model invests pretty heavily into solar and wind PPA these first couple years prior to 2030. And then this cost difference for alternate case one does continue to increase through the duration of the study. And this is an assumption in our model that both solar and wind PPAs over time are going to begin to be compensated less per megawatt hour of power they generate from the MISO energy market, so the day ahead. This assumption is built on a trend that we've observed historically for a lot of resources, primarily renewable resources that are located in remote regions. Where they are really negatively impacted by surrounding projects, particularly for wind. This has been true. So this assumption is built into our forecast. As for alternate case two, you can see there are some variations here in projected costs relative to base, but really it's fairly flat over time. And this is primarily due to our assumption that renewable energy credit prices are going to remain constant over the duration of our study. Part of the reason why we assumed a constant price for REC is because we didn't know that we could currently lock in long-term renewable energy credit purchases at a fixed price. So, Columbia wanted to lock in a certain amount of REC each year, but you can do so for a 10, 15 year period at a fixed price. So that's why we assumed that fixed price for REC.
Brandon, before we get off these two alternative cases, one of the questions that we've received is, with something like a REC, have you seen in your research that it does incentivize new renewable energy coming on, like new plant, or new openings, or is it just kind of a wash?
I certainly think it's a piece of the puzzle for incentivizing renewables. I mean, you have the piece of tax credit for different types of renewable technologies, and then you have this additional incentivization for renewable energy credits. I would say for renewable energy credits in particular, because they're used generally to meet our renewable energy requirement by state, for example. Generally, the state requirement is the driver of investment into renewable energy technology, and the REC is just kind of a byproduct of that requirement. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, the state of Iowa, if they had a requirement, they're meeting their goals, but we also can be claiming their credits. If we purchase them,
right? For example, if a utility has more renewable energy credits than they necessarily need for state requirements, they can sell the excess and save a little bit of money that way.
Yeah, Nick.
Well, the goal here is to reduce carbon in the atmosphere. So, what impact do RECs have on that? Are you able to quantify that in any way?
So we didn't assume that the use of RECs would change, the generation for the rest of Columbia's generation fleet. We didn't evaluate how that would impact total carbon emissions across an entire system. That wasn't.
But in general, are we able to say that it does or doesn't?
I think we would need to evaluate further. I mean, in general, you would think purchasing these credits from somebody, generally the resources are already there, the generation resources are already there. By and large, purchasing RECs, generally, you're not reducing the amount of carbon that's being emitted in the atmosphere.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Now, moving on to alternate case three. So in this scenario, we assume, again, 100% renewable energy requirement by 2030, with the assumption that Columbia would divest from its existing coal fleet. This includes Sikeston, Ithan, and Prairie State purchase power agreements that Columbia currently has. Now, the site for this plant is scheduled to retire sometime, I would assume, in the next 10 years, given the resources age. However, the Iocane and Prairie State coal plants are not expected to retire. I believe the current purchase power agreements go through at 2040, if I'm not mistaken. And so we assume that in order to divest from the Iocane and Prairie State contract, Columbia would have to pay the fixed cost associated with these contracts from 2030 through the remaining life of the existing contracts. So that would be 10 years of a fixed cost payment. And so, you know, this is built into the net present value calculation, but the total for $726 million of assumed cost of divestiture for both Iocane and Prairie State. Discounting this down, that is around $613 million impact on the net present value. Before I get into the actual built retirement decision, I just wanted to mention that as a part of our assumptions for the study. So getting into the build and retirement decision, you can see in this scenario, the model elects to invest in 250 megawatts of wind and solar PPAs from 2028 to 2031. In addition to this, it elects to invest into additional solar PPAs in 2033, and then a couple years of our study when we have some of the wind purchase power agreements rolling off now last year. You can see in 2030 where we had assumed a loss of 137 megawatts of existing thermal capacity. That again, sites in Prairie State and Iocane divestiture. The impact on net present value, overall increase of $613 million, with an impact on levelized cost of energy of right around $36 per megawatt hour increase. Again, really the biggest driver here is that cost of divestiture from Columbia's existing coal contract. All right, going into alternate case four. In this scenario, we assume, again, 100% renewable energy requirement. Also, that Columbia would divest from its coal resources in 2030 and then retire its existing natural gas fleet in 2035. Now, in our net present value calculation for this scenario, we have that same assumed cost of divestiture from the Iocane and Prairie State contract. In addition to this, Columbia's existing transmission system would need an upgrade in order to be able to retire the Columbia Energy Center and plant the local natural gas units. We assumed that transmission upgrade cost would be around $90 million in 2035 in order to retire those resources. So getting into the build and retirement decision, as we've seen with all the prior alternate cases one and three, the model is electing to build a combination of wind and solar purchase power agreements, 250 megawatts of wind and solar from 2028 to 2031, again, in order to meet that 100% renewable energy requirement. In addition to this, the model elects to further invest into solar purchase power agreement 35, and then in the last couple of years of our study. Something I want to note, under the existing thermal, you can see again that loss of 137 megawatts of nameplate capacity for the coal resources. And then in 2035, a loss of 191 megawatts of natural gas resources. Another thing I want to mention here is our model is electing to purchase a very large amount of bilateral capacity beginning in 2034. This is to ensure that the utility is meeting its planning requirements from MISO, particularly with the natural gas, those resources provide a large amount of burning capacity. And so if they're retired, then the utility is pretty largely short firm capacity. So the model sees that Columbia has to purchase it bilaterally from another utility or generation. Overall impact on net present value, there is a $723 million increase in NPV over the 20-year period. Again, that's being heavily impacted by the cost of divestiture from the coal resources and that transmission upgrade cost for the natural gas, local natural gas resource retirement. And then an increase of the levelized cost of energy to $103.15 per megawatt. All right, our last alternate case here, alternate case five, in this scenario, again, 100% renewable energy requirement by 2030, but we assume that the Sikeston coal plant would retire early in 2028. Getting into our build-in retirement decisions, as we've seen with previous scenarios, the model is choosing to invest in a combination of 250 megawatts of wind PPAs and 250 megawatts of solar PPAs from 2028 to 2031, again, to meet that renewable energy requirement. Kind of similar to previous scenarios, you can see the model elects to invest further in the solar purchase power agreement in 2038, and then in the last 2 years of this study. In 2028, you can see that retirement of the Sikeston coal plant and the loss of 66 megawatts of nameplate capacity under the existing thermal section. And then the last thing I'll mention for built-in retirements, you can see the model does elect to purchase a bit of bilateral capacity in the first 2 years, but by 2030, our model is seeing that both the solar and wind PPAs are providing enough firm capacity so where Columbia doesn't have to purchase again bilaterally until 2036. Overall impact to net present value, you can see 157 million dollar increase in net present value when compared to our base case over the 20-year period, and then right around that $90 per megawatt hour increase in that level A. One thing I will mention, as we kind of saw with alternate case one, this increase in net present value pretty heavily driven by the fact that some of this investment into wind and solar PPAs does have to be made during the mid 2020s when there still is some premium in the cost of these PPAs, particularly for solar. So that is driving some of that increase there in NPV.
Yeah, Nick.
So I have a question here. This assumes that Sikeston retires early of its own accord, correct? This isn't a divestiture.
That's correct. Correct. Yeah.
And if Sikeston were to retire earlier, would the renewable PPAs be available to replace those? Say if it happened in 25 or 26, would we be able to enter into PPAs that would cover our need that we would be losing from Sikeston?
That'd be questionable.
So like rather than having to invest in the bilateral capacity,
right,
just through, yeah.
I think it'd be questionable.
What?
I think it'd be questionable if you could get an agreement and get energy in that amount.
So in that case, we'd be doing the bilaterals earlier.
Right.
Okay.
And I guess my question for this is, you have it retiring early at 28. Isn't it kind of scheduled to retire in 30 anyway? When is it?
We don't really know. They won't us a date of when they think they may shut down.
Okay.
Okay. And I've got information that says they're planning on possibly building a different facility. They're exploring, you know, solar, gas.
Right. But that would be a new agreement. That would not be our existing. Yes. Right. Right.
And they're building a new substation as we speak.
Yeah.
So I don't think they'd be putting that investment in if they thought they were going to be shutting down within a couple of years.
Okay. Huh. And then I just have a quick question before you move on, Brandon. So on each of these five, you've had a row that says battery storage PPA, but you've never had any numbers in there.
Right. So, you know, the model really, it wasn't selecting my battery storage PPAs in any of our scenarios. Part of the reason is, you know, the technology is still fairly expensive. And especially if your goal is to achieve 100% renewable energy, a battery project really isn't going to help too much there, right? It's not generating electricity or storing it for a later point in time. So that's really why the model didn't select battery storage PPAs in any scenario. I kept it in there just to kind of make that clear.
Okay.
So looking at this same cost difference comparison for our last three alternate cases, again, these bars are showing the difference in costs annually between our last three cases and the base case. You know, this first slide really just to kind of show that the difference in cost for alternate case 3 and 4 really is just occurring during 2030. And then for alternate case 4 during 2035, again, that cost of divestiture and then transmission operating costs, which would be required to retire Columbia's local gas generation. This next slide here, I adjusted the y-axis to better, for us to better be able to see the differences in cost over time. And really, you know, some of these main takeaways here, the differences in costs are largely outside of 2030 and 35, largely similar to what we saw on alternate case 1, where we have some incremental increases in cost difference over time due to the additional investments into solar and wind PPAs during the late 2020s, early 2030s, and then some small incremental investments in additional solar PPAs in the mid 2030s. This slide here, this is really taking the high level results from each of these alternate cases as well as our base case and comparing the different build new resource additions as well as the difference in 20-year levelized cost of energy. So what we're looking at here is for each of our six model runs, the bars are showing the new resource nameplate capacity addition. And again, they're grouped by fuel type, and those belong to the left-hand y-axis. And then the black dots here are showing the 20-year levelized cost of energy belonging to the right-hand axis. Something I want to note, you know, this right-hand axis, right-hand y-axis, using it adjusted to better see visually some of the cost differences between the scenarios. Just wanted to mention that. You know, really some takeaways here. You know, as we saw, alternate case 3 and 4 had the largest cost increases due to those divestitures from coal from Columbia's existing coal contract, as well as a transmission upgrade in alternate case 4. The last thing I'll mention here for REC, you know, we do see an alternate case 2.
have shown the red volume here. This is just reflecting the maximum amount of purchases in one given year that will be needed to reach that 100% renewable energy requirement. Wanted to mention that. All right. And the last slide I have for today's presentation, our main takeaways. I'll go through these in order here for us. Really the largest impact that we saw to Columbia financially in this study when achieving this 100% renewable goal is if the utility retires its existing thermal resources early. This is true for both the coal and the natural gas resources. I do want to mention one thing that we didn't evaluate in this study was the risk of MISO not approving a retirement of either of one of the natural gas resources in particular. These resources have to be approved by MISO for retirement, and there are risks if MISO doesn't approve that retirement. Another thing that we really saw the main takeaway from this study is that if Columbia retires its existing thermal resources, there's a pretty substantial amount of bilateral capacity that needs to be purchased in order to make sure the utility is meeting its planning requirements. One thing I want to mention is we assumed the bilateral capacity Columbia would be purchasing would be from any available resource. Columbia strictly wanted to purchase bilateral capacity from a renewable resource, it would likely result in some increases in cost that you, or excuse me, the price that you would be paying for that bilateral capacity. The third main takeaway that we have here is really that there's value in setting incremental goals for renewables as opposed to a single goal in 1 year. So for example, we were setting a 40, 60, 80% renewable goal in different increments. This goes back to the renewable PPA price forecast that we looked at earlier. We are assuming that in the near term, particularly solar PPA prices are at a pretty high premium, and that's going to be relaxed over time. If you set incremental goals, you're more able to sort of dollar cost average the price that you're locking in for solar PPAs in particular, as opposed to just having to make that investment in a 2 to 3 year time span. Right? There's the risk of that there will be substantial technological improvements or additional financial incentives for these renewable technologies in the future that we just can't predict. One thing I do want to mention from a planning perspective, there are additional risks if with losing Columbia's local generation fleet, natural gas fleet, during extreme weather events, and we did not evaluate the risks associated with extreme weather events in this study. And then the last main takeaway I have here is regarding the assumed transmission upgrade costs. We assumed Columbia would have to invest in a transmission upgrade in order to retire its existing natural gas fleet. Likely that couldn't be done by 2035 after some additional review. And the upgrade cost that we came to was just an estimate. I did want to note, further evaluations have to be done in order to determine impacts to reliability and to establish some more definite costs for that that potential upgrade that they need. All right. This is my last slide. Do we have any questions on any aspect of the presentation or additional things you would
sure we have questions, but we also probably have discussion and questions. So I'm wondering, Dave, what else do you have as far as staff presentation? And then don't go anywhere, Brandon, because especially with this slide, we want to come back to it, I'm sure. And I'm just keeping an eye on time. So what's your time like? I just want to know.
I don't have a whole lot of time to take.
Okay.
Or your discussion or direction.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and pull up.
Well, Brandon, can you stop sharing, please?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
You're all right.
Yeah, that's true. So we took all these different scenarios they gave us from their model, and we calculated it up, the cumulative cost increase to the utility for each one of those scenarios through the 20-year period of time. And after we saw the costs for the case 3, 4, and 5, we said, well, those are so expensive, we don't think there's even any justification to try to determine the rate impact to present the council. So we did the rate impact with alternate case 1 and the case 2, which was using the REC. And case 1 is pretty substantial because in order to do that, based on the time frame they proposed to get to 2030, would cumulative increase to rates would be 24.5%. And that does not take into account the renewable energy we already are buying. It also does not take into account any rate adjustments that would be needed for operational increases not related to energy purchases, such as increased wages or just inflation for materials and supplies. The scenario using the RECs and the combination of a solar PPA, it's showing about a 4%. Those also don't take in any other operational increases that would be necessary.
Right.
Go to the next.
Sorry, everyone's sneezing.
So we need a. So we've got a goal in our ordinance now for a certain percentage by certain dates. And with delay in Iron Star, we're not quite meeting the 25% goal. If Iron Star comes online in 28, we will meet that 25% goal that would be in this time frame. They have potential additional energy available. We've requested 18 additional megawatts, which would put us over the 30% if they were to come online in 28. So that would meet the current goals and the ordinance in the time frame of 28. But our climate action and adaptation plan has a different goal. It says we need to get to 100% renewable energy generation or purchase by 2035. It proposes removing the 3% rate cap that's in our current ordinance. And then it talks about the possibility of using RECs to meet those 100% requirements. And then we have a group of people who are suggesting we go to 100% by 2030. Based on what DEA has said, I think that there is some value in having incremental goals and not picking a date and saying we need to be there. With what we've seen, I don't think it's very realistic that the facilities will be available by 2030. They're taking years to build after they put the proposed project in review.
So by facilities, you mean generators?
Yeah, the solar fields, wind turbines, whatever. I don't know that they'd be physically able to be built with just how long it's taking. But I think what I would like, I mean, I think renewable energy is great and we need to keep looking at it and we need to move towards it in a physically responsible way. I would really like to know, should we come back with an ordinance revision? Which one of these goals is it that we are trying to achieve? That's one of my big questions. Are we trying to go for 2030 or is it 2035 or are we content with what the existing ordinance has? It's rather confusing for us to know when to put RFPs together and go out when we're not even certain what the goal is.
Is there another side or is that been?
Okay. That's it. And then I just remind you, we did do RFPs earlier this year and they were extremely expensive.
questions from council then? I think one question on the last one for the solar one that we received this year. What do we know what percentage it was over the rate? You know, the 3%, what was the difference?
It would have required something like a what we figure up a 12%, 12% or 13% rate increase just to pay for the additional cost for one of those RFPs if we entered a contract.
And when we did the cost adjustment this year, because last year we experienced that with just our normal energy where we had an increase above what we expected. What was the percentage of that jump that we had last year with the purchase, the power that we purchased?
The total purchase power in 22?
Mm-hmm.
About $22.5 million.
Yeah. I guess I'm just thinking like when the 3%, you know what I mean? Like when we talked about this, we probably locked in our assumption on cost a lot more in 2012 and previously than right now. So I come back to the slide of from TEA and that third bullet that they had where they talk about the idea of the incremental renewable goals, like that idea. And for me, it just comes back to this saying I recently heard, which was, I want to pass on a lighter baton than the one I was given. And I feel that really strong with a lot of the decisions I make on council, where I know some of the things were made under previous councils, previous water and light advice, you know, all these things. And I think about this future. So I'm also not tied to having a firm thing that's going to cost us a 10% increase in rates in the next 2 years. Like, I don't think anyone on council wants that. But I think we do want something in there that is saying, like, you know, we want to get there as fast as we can at a pace that is feasible, right? Financially as well as physically. And we want to know what advice to give you to do that. Right. And so I don't want to put an arbitrary date on a thing or a dollar. I want to know that when it's set out there, that it is being accomplished. And so I don't know if it's that I want you to do implement strategy E1.3. You know, I don't know if that's it. So I guess that's what I'm asking you is, how can you operationalize that goal? Grant, if my council consents, you know, I think that's the question that we're asking.
I mean, I think we need to continue to try to achieve additional renewables, but I think we have to evaluate the physical reality of, can we do it? You know, because like the two solar PPAs that we've entered into, the first one didn't come online for 5 years. Mm-hmm. The second one has been 5 years and they haven't started construction yet. So physically, building these facilities is taking a large amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think we also need to be very aware of what the impact to the ratepayers is going to be. And we got to realize that if we're buying a lot of energy from renewables and we already are buying that energy from coal-fired power plants, we have to take a huge financial risk that we can sell that on the market and not lose money. And I think there's been other communities that have done that and have made themselves bonds, I think, in order to pay the bills.
And so you're talking about, like, when I look at the summer load capacity imbalance, that additional, you know, like the renewables, whatever additional we can add in that, with the knowledge that for some of these things, it doesn't show us on slide 16 of this that Sikeston is going away, even though we know sometime in here it is. So that gray bar will go down. So all of our renewable, you know what I mean? Like, I guess it's.
If Sikeston, for instance, if we find out they're going to shut down, then I think we should very aggressively go after.
Well, it sounds like we need to aggressively be going after it now because it's going to take 7 years before any of these things come on.
TEA's deal, the production assumes that you signed the PPA 3 years before, and from what they had on there, we would need to be signing these things in late 20s or early 30s.
Right. And I guess that's, so then, right. And so obviously that's the question is, how do I then put that in? Because that's just operational. So I guess you're saying you want us to have a goal.
I want the three different confusing goals to somehow be clarified.
So the first one, that's section 27106B, but previous to that, it says what? It's going to be
certain percentage by certain dates.
Mm-hmm. And that differs from the cap. And if the cap says 100% by 2030.
It's the one that has the incremental. So the two, so it's an incremental.
I just haven't read it.
2004 voter adopted, 2012 changed by council.
That's what I was getting at, is that if the Iron Star project does come online in 2028, we'll have met the 25% goal. And that project was, we were supposed to receive power from them in 2021. And then if we get the additional 18 megawatts, we will have met the 30% goal that's in the current code. So our current contracts, if the energy is being delivered, meets the current goal.
About ordinance.
But it doesn't meet the goal in the climate action adaptation. Very challenging to try to figure out which one is the one you're really supposed to be.
Well, in speaking from the history of when the climate action plan was put out, part of that was why it said to codify it through ordinance, right? Because the idea is, because it's understanding that the ordinance, so the renewable energy portfolio standard, is the current ordinance. It's the only one guiding, right? Climate Action Adaptation Plan, like a comp plan, is a policy resolution, which is supposed to guide our policy, what we do. But then things like the UDC, you know what I mean, is how you implement it. So I think, you know, it was probably just last year when council finally said, what are we doing to codify the renewable energy goal to increase the percentage? Which is why we've been having the conversation today. Yeah, Don.
What would you say would be a achievable annual goal of moving towards renewables? 1%, 3%, 5%? And again, that's the goal. Understand, like you pointed out, a lot of these projects are taking much longer to come online than anticipated. So I realize that's a complicating factor.
I don't know. I hadn't thought about it as far as going down to very small percentages on an annual basis.
You know, a step at a time. But
we need to look into that and get back and see what's the likelihood of. Would we be able to get a PPA for very small amounts off of a solar facility or wind facility?
Well, I mean, if a couple of years, if there's a year or two where we manage to take a bigger step, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, but just as our goal, and then looking back, just like losing weight, a pound a week, will make a big difference in a year. 3% a year, in 20 years, we're going to be 60%.
We definitely can look into additional information.
Thanks.
And I think I'd be interested too in what the conversation has been with the Water and Light Advisory Board, who obviously heard this in July, in the conversation. So I see Greg, are you the current chair?
Yeah.
Do you mind coming and hanging out with us?
Yeah, I'm going to come up because I'm a little quiet.
We're like Davis. Yeah, we know him.
I don't have anything prepared. That's right. But I did jump to know staff while we're chatting a little bit. And I think from our standpoint of the Water Light Advisory Board, I mean, we and four of the five of us came from the task force. So to go back to the task force, it's really kind of another goal. The task force kind of recommended that we pursue renewable energy up to 100%, we do it incrementally and financially balanced.
Right.
So similar to the ordinances today, we want to continue to do that. Maybe we can achieve it by 2035, but it might be take longer. It really depends on the availability and the price of those energies.
Great. Can I ask really quick in that vein, did you have a suggestion of what those percentage increases would be in the dates going with that?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
And we did talk at length, and not only in the task force, but also in the board about
the fact that our current ordinance kind of caps us out at 30%. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is the next increment? And maybe that's what Dave is looking for is,
right.
Okay, what is our next increment that we're going to keep trying for? It always bounces. One thing nice about this ordinance is it has a financial cap. So if you can't get that renewable energy in the right price, you're going to, you know, punt and go out later to see if you can get it. So it's really a great model, and it's worked really well for the community. But it does end in 2028 as far as the goal. Yeah, I think the we agree that the incremental investment in the board was the right way to go. You know, just continue to do an incremental investment for renewable energy, and it has to be balanced financially. It also, the thing we talked about is recommending the update to the ordinance. And also, we as a collective group really didn't think that the RECs were the right way to go. We see that it could be make you achieve it a little bit faster, but really a much more valuable alternative is to actually get a true renewable energy asset, especially if it's in nearby, you know, in Missouri or regionally at least. So it's a true asset that we have partnership in to meet our goals. And this is my recommendation, not necessarily the board, but I've mentioned it several times in the conversation, is that this is such a big decision. I know the ordinance really went out to the vote of the public. If we were to make a much more broad goal going forward, it might be time to take it back to the public and let them vote, all the ratepayers and voters in the community, if they want to do a more aggressive stance or a more moderate stance. So, Tom, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I was going to throw in what you said, which would be number four, just to make it just a little more confusing, which is where we came out. We actually discussed this in the task force, and the specific response that Austin Energy had, because we used them as a guide for a lot of the work we did on CAP. And they cite the Canary in the Coal Mine example of Georgetown, Texas, which decided we're just going to buy all the energy we need to be 100% by a particular time, which means they overbought and they got slaughtered trying to sell back energy in a market that wasn't favorable. So Austin Energy and the Sierra Club, Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club, says do not do this, which is scenarios 1 and 2 here. And instead they say, do what we're doing. We're going to do it incrementally, which means an annual RFP for clean energy, but doing it in measured amounts. The assumptions they made about assume that you'll be able to have power within 3 years of signing the contract is extremely aggressive. As we know, the queues at MISO are 5 years, possibly a little bit longer. And the solutions they talk about are still in study, so they haven't even implemented. So we should assume that, which means in 2024, we should probably have at least 10 RFPs for 250 megawatts of clean energy, because we got shut out in the last two. It was too expensive. So we have to assume that we're going to put a whole bunch of, to meet this by 2030,